Good morning. This is a turning out to be maybe a solo show this morning for the Game Week 9 Net That Hall matchups review show. Just me, Gabe here at FPLNs with you as I drink my coffee and get ready to kind of launch this ship. I'm sure I'm going to crash it as I usually do. Good to see K7 in the chat here. Just us, kind of like a solo show today. I don't know. Lucien might join us. He had a bit of an emergency this morning with one of his daughters. Apparently, it was a big mess. Apparently, it was massive. I don't know exactly what happened. But he does have notes. I'll be referring to his notes on all the shows, and I have some notes as well. It was quite a week for matchups, I have to say. And after 8 game weeks, I think patterns are beginning to emerge. Things are really starting to take shape here. And now is really an exciting time for matchups because they're really starting to bang, and we'll get to a couple of those in just a moment here. I will warn you there might be a couple errors in the slides here. Didn't have time to put it all together this morning. But we are going to move forward here because we did have a late start. And I have an appointment in about an hour, and I'm sure you're all eager to get to the reviews. So this is the slide that didn't work out for us. So I'm going to turn over here. This was the this is the preview for Game Week 9. But before we get to the preview for Game Week 9, let's just go over the results the preview for Game Week 10. Let's go over the results for Game Week 9. We have Liverpool 2, Everton 0, Bournemouth 1, Wolves 2, Brentford 3, Burnley 0, Manchester City 2, Brighton 1, Newcastle 4, Palace 0, Forest 2, Luton 2, Chelsea 2, Arsenal 2, Sheffield United 1, Manchester United 2, Aston Villa 4, West Ham 1, and Spurs 2, Fulham 0 on Monday night. Moving on here, I think let's see what we got going on here. So this is just the overall review of all the data for Game Week 9. You can come see it here at two and a half minutes into the show. Just to provide an overview before we get into it here. I think the a lot of standouts. You'll notice in NXG was quite close to the scores, and you'll see like the zonals matched up really well, but let's get right into the matchups here and reviewing Game Week 9 here. We'll go to the first matchup. And, of course, it is Liverpool-Everton. Lucien has some notes. He says, I wrote here, I expect Salah to be between Mikolenko and Branthwaite. He says, Salah must receive the ball off the left, and it comes down to who finds him in that area. At the moment, tactics point that way as Jota does selfless work. So I think what Lucien is telling us here is that in this game, it kind of depends like who's going to get the ball to Salah. For example, if Szoboszlai is going to step into the half space, Salah might be a little wider when he receives the ball. But I think if I turn to my notes over here, bear with me while I bring those up real quickly. So my notes in this one, I thought it was really interesting. Obviously, highlighting Salah. Salah was the obvious call in this one. GV Subramanian, thanks for joining us. Nice to see you here. He says, looks like apart from Salah, Watkins, Son, and Trippier, there isn't any player delivering returns consistently. That may be the case. I don't know that could be changing. It depends what kind of returns you're looking for. I think some players are maybe not hauling, but still continuing to return. In this one in particular, you know, Salah was the obvious call. He got 2 goals, 1.39 XG, but he also had 3 key passes in this game. So he, passes leading to a shot there. So he's still a creator as well. And I think in that sense, it keeps him in the points. And that's why he's like an obvious get, because he creates and he finishes. So Jota, I highlighted Jota. I really thought Jota would do more here statistically, but he ended up creating space for Diaz instead of doing things for himself. Another point here is Diaz was excellent again. I highlighted Diaz, and it may seem like that was a bad call or a bad person to highlight there. But he created the penalty. He should have had another penalty that wasn't called. Again, poor refereeing. But I thought he was excellent and pivotal to Liverpool. So I thought that was a good call in this one. Pardon me while I call. What else we got here? McNeil to Calvert-Lewin, first minute, happened right away. McNeil was a tactical sub after Young's red card, but that is something that that Everton was certainly going to try to do, hit Liverpool's right hand side. And again, everybody's kind of like recognizing that weakness, so it's really something that I'll be targeting in my articles every week. Target Liverpool's right. That's where their weakness is. That's where you can get penetration. So that obviously the red card changed the game in this one, but we saw that in the first minute. Maybe can expect a little bit of a better finish there from Calvert-Lewin. And then the last part, obviously, chaos in a derby, red card chaos right from the beginning. So that part of it hit as well. So yeah, this is largely a successful prediction, and Liverpool assets are really starting to pop, especially Mohamed Salah. But Watkins is also starting to pop. So it's just what kind of balance are you going to strike for your team, I think, is the question moving forward. Almost 7 minutes in, going to get to the second matchup here. Thank you again for joining us. We got about 10 people joining us live here again. It's just me solo today. I don't know. Lucien might join us if he ends up picking up a mess that his daughter's made. I'm really dying to hear what this mess was, because it sounds just like massive. So let's move on to the next one, though. Bournemouth versus Wolves. Okay, we'll go to Lucien's notes here. It's a shame we don't have Lucien on the show today, because obviously he is a Wolves fan. And yeah, I mean, Bournemouth, they still haven't shown us who they are yet, have they? So I don't know. Bournemouth versus Wolves, obviously with the late win, coming back at the end, but it is that player that I've been highlighting for quite some time. And it's Sasha Kalajdzic. He's just such a simple, obvious target. It's, I mean, 6 foot, 100, and just get the ball to him. You have people that can definitely create and serve the ball, like Pedro Neto. Pedro Neto, 9 crosses, 0.34 XG, 0.33 XA, 1 assist in the game. Could have had more. I mean, continues to be the standout. That call was bang on. I'm happy with that one. The Kalajdzic call, even though he didn't start, just a target man, and effectively enough, he gets the winner for Wolves. Jose Sa, I highlighted him. I didn't think Bournemouth would get much, but Bournemouth got an early goal. Jose Sa still had 3 saves and 0.17 expected goals prevented, which is decent. It's a shame he conceded that goal, or else that call would have been bang on as well. But again, like, watch for Wolves. Wolves are a changing team, and they certainly aren't the offensively inept team that we saw last season. I thought Cunha played better in this one as well. And maybe that's why Sasha Kalajdzic and Cunha are just such different players. So I guess it makes sense for Cunha to continue to start as he has more skills, I guess, in his tool belt, right? So it makes sense for him to start, and Kalajdzic to be an impact player. K7 says Neto missed a big chance. Yes, he did. And he will miss those, but he's just everything kind of goes through him, all the creativity, the services, and he can get the goal as well. So he seems like a really, really great asset in FPL. It's just a little bit hard to trust. I think we still have a little bit of old Wolves in our heads. They are changing, but maybe a team that is in change like that can be somewhat inconsistent as well. Pretty happy with the calls in this one, with Neto, Kalajdzic, and Jose Sa. kind of coming through here. Let's see what Lucien has to say really quick on this one, because he's a Wolves fan. He says that the width opens space for Billing. So that is true, that Iraola finally got some width. Tavernier and Brooks are, as midfield players with history operating as center mids, provide a lot more link play with Solanke, counterintuitive against their usual wide press philosophy. So those players are being used more to link play, but there hasn't been much space. So I'd like to see more width play from Iraola. I think Iraola might be on his last leg here. He has to come up with a result really soon here. I mean, despite the very difficult start for Bournemouth, those difficult fixtures, you expect to see at least a little some signs of his plans, and his plans don't seem to be working right now. Key takeaways from Lucien's perspective here is Bournemouth's insistence on patient passing from the back, just like Wolves a season ago, is having ramifications, but their attacking is starting to show cohesion. So their attacking is starting to show cohesion. It showed in that Billing goal, but they are a subdued attack because they're still learning the ball movement, and they haven't kind of progressed to the penetrating side yet. We'll see if Iraola is given time. I'd be really curious to see that. And then Lucien's note on Wolves is the Wolves finishing still has an issue of low XG. Low SG hit post shot XG. I don't know what that means. Versus highest XG not hitting target. Oh, I see. So their low XG shots are hitting the target, so they're registering a post shot XG, but their high XG shots are missing the target. So that's a problem for Wolves. And as their chances involve a high degree of difficulty. But their wing back system is looking much more polished. So we'll see if they can continue to turn it on. K7 has Neto, and I considered Neto. I really did. There are so many options in midfield, and that structure is going to be really interesting. I decided to go Gordon instead of Neto. Well, I'm pretty happy about that selection, but Neto owners, I'm sure, are happy as well. About 12 and a half minutes, moving on to the next matchup here, Brentford-Burnley. Brentford-Burnley. Blessing in disguise. What is it for Everton? Causes proactive strategy to punish Bournemouth on several levels. I don't know. Not really getting Lucien's notes here. But yeah, I don't know. That this match, I think, really, really favored Brentford, and Brentford very much came through. I think a couple of the things from my notes in particular that I was showing here are... Where's my Brentford Burnley? Here we go. I highlighted Wissa. I thought that the kind of the cluster on Brentford's right-hand side matched the cluster of Burnley's left-hand side. And so I thought there would be a lot of just like congestion in there, and Wissa could be kind of in space. And true enough, Wissa scored a goal, 1.2 XG. He also had three key passes, which is interesting. And that leads me to the other side, is highlighting Mbeumo, because Mbeumo plays on that right side where all the congestion was going to be. And if the ball is going to be on the side where Mbeumo is, I'd still like him to get something. He got a goal plus an assist, 1.55 XGI, four shots on target, three key passes. So put Mbeumo around the ball and things will happen, as long as, I want to say, as long as the opposition is not too difficult. And obviously Burnley does not present a difficult opposition. I think the one call that was off in this game was the headed matchup for Brentford, 4.4 headed matchup with 12.6 shots in the box predicted. And I thought that would materialize into something for Pinnock or something like that. But that headed matchup didn't really come to fruition in this one, maybe because they found it so easy elsewhere. I got to be honest, this one, I didn't watch this game. I just saw the highlights. So again, several of the calls kind of like a bang on in this one. Definitely congratulations to Mbeumo owners. And I wonder if you'll be selling him soon. Let me know in the chat. Manchester City, Brighton, obviously a matchup that a fixture a lot of people were looking forward to. And, you know, Manchester City 2, Brighton 1. Kind of in line with the stats here, with the Manchester City 1.5 net XG and a Brighton 0.6. When you take teams that know how to finish like these two, or take that back a little bit. Sometimes Brighton struggle with finishing, but this season, both of these teams have had decent shooting stats, or decent shot on target stats, decent finishing stats. We see Manchester City's shots matchup goal predictor there is a little bit lower, but this one kind of really matched up to the stats. Manchester City 2, Brighton 1 would be a logical prediction based on the FDR and the net XG here. So I thought that was bang on. We do have to wonder about Holland's finish, superb, and he can create something like that, almost not quite from nothing. It was a chance, but he was outside of the box, but just the power with which he hit that shot near post was really nice. But these numbers, these three big chances, these numbers aren't really playing out for Manchester City. And one thing that I didn't note here was the impact of Doku. And I think somebody, yes, GV just mentioned Brighton on a slide and Doku emerging as a creative player. Yeah, I didn't realize how much Manchester City was going to rely on Doku in this one. And I also didn't realize that James Milner was going to start at right back. So if I would have foreseen James Milner starting at right back against Manchester City, I certainly would have highlighted the left side instead of the right side. I pointed out the right side, and some goodness did come from the right side. Foden, there's something up with Foden. He seems like a frustrated player inside, personally. Everything is a complaint to the refs, and I thought some of his complaints were quite legitimate, to be perfectly honest, but he's a player playing in his head, not on the field. So keep an eye for him. Hopefully Manchester City kind of like can do something a little bit different with that side. And regarding Doku on the left, it'll be interesting to see if Jack Grealish will start to make an impact there. I don't know if Doku can play on the right or not. I guess I can look that up. I'm just not sure if he could fill that role. Overall, regarding the stats, kind of a really good predictions for this one from a statistical perspective, not so much from a zonal or a personnel perspective. But given these two teams are extremely attacking, I thought that and the stats were saying otherwise. I thought the fact that the stats pointed this one out was really encouraging. Moving on, Newcastle versus Crystal Palace. I think people are finally starting to realize that Newcastle are one of the best attacks in the league, especially at home. I mean, they've handled so many teams at home this season. Just in really convincing fashion, and I think what's most surprising is with they've done it with different personnel. They've rotated, they've had injuries, and they maintain their identity and style of play. They have the two best celebratory smiles in the league in Miguel Almirón and Jacob Murphy. So that's awesome to see them react. Jacob Murphy, I'm happy for him. I'm really pissed off that he wasn't offside, though. Goddamn, Trippier keeps killing me in FPL. But this is another one. Newcastle is one that for some reason, this is a team that for matchups, but matchups really likes Newcastle. They're a team that I get their system. I understand the personnel. I highlighted Gordon going up against Joel Ward. And Gordon had one off the bar, scored a goal, 0.75 XG. He was flying past Ward all game. Really, really great game from Gordon. And I know K7, you have Neto. I think Gordon is the best sub 6 million asset in the game, just because of how prolific this attack is. I just always want a piece of the Newcastle attack, and sometimes unsure how to get in there. If there's going to be rotation at the nine with Isak and Wilson, if there's injury at the nine, there's certainly rotation on the right side. And I think Gordon is just like such a nice way in there. In addition to Trippier, which I can't get to, unfortunately. Speaking of Trippier, he had an assist, could have had more, 0.48 XG, which is really nice. Another solid game for him. Just talismanic, I have to say, in terms of chance creation. He keeps bringing it every week, and then just like an obvious shout for statistical production. And then lastly, Callum Wilson. He finally got his goal towards the end there, but he did have 0.74 XG. He headed matchup panned out. The headed matchup of 4.3 here. Callum Wilson won 2 out of 3 aerial duels, got his goal. So I thought those calls were really good. The headed matchup panned out in this one. And it often does with Newcastle, to be perfectly honest. So that'll take us through this one. Let's see if Lucien might be on his way in here. So I might give him a moment to see if he can get himself from backstage on stage here. His key takeaways for this one, he says that the central midfielders make the wingers, basically Gordon and Trippier are the wingers for Newcastle, look really, really good. And those two central midfielders. Now, it's interesting that Newcastle are about to lose Tonali for quite a while. So that'll be interesting to see how that changes them. Longstaff got a red card. When did Longstaff get a red card? He's still suspended. And so it'll be interesting to see how that midfield changes and how the change in midfield without Tonali precisely affects those wingers. Let's see. Lucien, can I bring you in here?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Welcome.
Oh my gosh. I literally fell asleep right in front of the laptop.
No problem. You fell asleep. Well, you're joining us at a decent time. We got the show going here. Haven't crashed the ship just yet. I'm just finishing up Newcastle versus Palace. Is there anything like just that really stood out? Matchups loves Newcastle. I get the Newcastle bang on, but anything else that stood out? I kind of went through your notes and your key takeaways and was about to move on to the next one, unless you have anything to add.
I think nothing for Newcastle, but something specific for Crystal Palace, because they continue to evolve and change without Schlupp, especially. Instead of having two central midfielders, now they're trying to use three central midfielders to cover all the space left behind. And there's going to be a little bit of turmoil in this period where Palace try to figure out how to work things out, because they tried to field Edouard Mateta and Ayew up front, and they need one more extra wing presence instead of having Lerma and two other central midfield players holding up the space. I think that's something that Newcastle exploited very well, because it wasn't consistently two Newcastle wing players against Tyrick Mitchell. A lot of the time, Palace had to shift one of the central midfielders laterally across just to cover Newcastle's wing threats.
That's really interesting, because Palace is going to host Arsenal in game week 10. And I mean, if Palace shift those center mids to cover the wing threats, then Odegaard could feast on that. If they don't, then Saka could feast, huh?
Yes. Arsenal have every reason to thrive down the flanks these next few days. Yeah.
Oh no. Who plays Palace next? Arsenal plays Sheffield United, right?
Yeah, that's in 10. Yes.
It's Spurs that plays because we have that dilemma. Like, how do we sell Son for Saka? Right? Spurs plays Palace. So you're mentioning Tyrick Mitchell. I highlighted the other side, which came to fruition against Newcastle. So would you in their upcoming fixture, right, against Tottenham? Again, I would highlight that left side. I mean, maybe just because I don't believe in Kulusevski, but Wait, but you think how do you attack Crystal Palace? And
Well, if I think, this one's tough because usually, right, if you imagine attacking Crystal Palace, you want to have majority of the ball against Joe Ward, as you've written down in your slides. I think that's occurred 90% of the time. And in this particular case, Newcastle's right, they just had that double up so often that it mattered so much more. So they didn't need Anthony Gordon actually going up against Joel Ward because, you know, the other side just kept creating. I mean, this was something we've debated, right? Like, when you create a chance against a side, does it mean that you score from that zone or do you create from that zone? So I think for Palace, I do feel that for the rest of the season, you are trying to own somebody from the left, right? So you're looking at either Son or Richarlison from the left going up 1v1 against Joel Ward. I just find that when we talk about the Spurs game later, a little bit of a spoiler, I don't think many of us imagine Spurs actually dribbling down the left, right? So this is definitely something we will look at. But I would say that we want to create from Joel Ward's flank, at least for the rest of the season. Mm. So that's the concept.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So that's interesting, especially if you're considering selling Spurs assets like I am or like I was. I'm not sure, but still debating that one. All right, okay, cool. We'll move on to the sixth matchup here. We're about halfway through, 26 minutes in, which is decent. I think we're going to stay on time today. Especially after this one, since this one should be pretty quick. Nottingham Forest 2 versus Luton 2. I can't believe Forest gave up this lead. Talk to us about this one.
Well, I mean, this is one of those cases where the goalkeeper's really... I mean, okay, so we talked about the number 10 position, right? And the space conceded between the lines still occurred, right? I mean, that's literally why some of us even triple captain Morgan Gibbs-White for this match. And, well, I think that's something that we've never considered about Forest, whether they actually depended on the number 10. So, okay, I'm going to pull up some stats for that particular Forest-Luton game because, right, when you look at the shot zones, especially for Forest, literally everything was inside the penalty area except for two particular shots. This is what happens when instead of having Gibbs-White sit behind Wood and, you know, some other winger, right, we had Wood still applying centrally, central pressure, and you have two sort of, it's sort of this lopsided formation, right, where Gibbs-White would instead bomb down the right side, as we expect, and he would just crash into the box. So this is what happens when you play with Chris Wood instead of Taiwo Awoniyi. You're not looking at that right to left far post presence, nor are you looking for that whole, you know, cross and look for Chris Wood's hit. So it's like saying that your number 10 in theory turns into a second striker. And that was pretty much it. They parked Luton into the box so hard, right? Especially since Luton played away from home, that Gibbs-White from a number 10 turned into a second number 9 himself. And so you notice that a lot of chances were created from the right side and everything was just parked inside the box. So that was the unfortunate thing that we didn't consider against Luton, who played away from home. This occurred whether Forest have possession, whether Luton gave the ball away in midfield, because like Luton can play any formation they want, whether three at the back or four at the back here. I think the crucial thing that Luton tried to do different was that they used Jacob Brown as a number 10 instead of a right forward or right wing back or a right-sided forward. So that basically contributed into this attack versus defense scenario that everyone expected, but just, you know, exaggerated so far that the game was basically played in Forrest's box. Sorry, Luton's box majority of the time. So that was how the game went.
Yeah, I was disappointed to see that Gibbs White didn't get something here, especially given those dynamics and the fact that the dynamics played out, but the results didn't. The case of right thinking, wrong outcome. In this case for Gibbs White. Gibbs White blanked, right? Just making sure. Yeah. Okay, moving on to the next one. I think Gibbs White was my kind of like a one-week darling, and it didn't really pan out here, but the thinking did. So, okay, fair enough. Chelsea-Arsenal. I'm gonna let you go in this one because I don't have much positive to say.
Yeah, I mean, it's a case of game state, right? I think, okay, so there are two perspectives that were touted of this game, right? Before a ball was even kicked. The first being the fact that this was technically a top six clash, and there's always going to be this London rivalry. So you have to ask yourself, right? Will both teams follow this sort of narrative that makes, you know, this whole thing extremely grand? Or do you just foresee it as Arsenal steamrolling Chelsea, as, you know, the stats should suggest? The problem here is that, you know, we've already mentioned that Chelsea are a very individualistic side. And, well, I think it goes to say that Modric's goal itself was a bit of a... we will continue to debate whether Modric's goal was intentional or not, right? Until, like, whenever. But most important thing
what
is
do you
that...
think?
Well, I'm not going to claim that I've scored that kind of goal before. But you can see the intention behind it. Like, you know, if I didn't know that that shot ended up as a goal, it would be entirely plausible based on Modric's body language, right? That it's one of those things where he looks like he wants to cross, but he can do something clever by lobbing the goalkeeper. It's been done. When you ignore the outcome and you look at purely his body language, it is plausible that he intentionally went for goal from that position. It's entirely plausible. I mean, sure, that kind of goal has been scored before, you know.
I've scored goals like that, and that's why I don't think it was deliberate. It didn't look like he was enacting the technique required to score the goal. It looked like he was trying to enact a technique to cross, and he just didn't do it well. That's what it looked like to me. But I get both sides. Yeah, well, it's arguable. It's debatable.
Well, in any case, I think it's good that I think for the first time in a while, right, it forced Arsenal to come back from 2-0 down away from home. So this was a good testament to see how Arsenal can dig deep. Now, just a quick note on Chelsea, because, you know, as much as we want to say that all Sterling deserve credit, Modric deserve credit on the left, we have to understand that Chelsea are now sort of finding their balance in terms of where their central midfield plays. Because I think for the longest time, we've assumed that Enzo Fernandez and Conor Gallagher were just, you know, hold up central midfield. And we see now that Gallagher is actually making a lot of incisive runs down the right half space. This is something that's going to enable a lot of, it's going to solve a lot of problems that Chelsea have down the flanks, right? Because we've always asked ourselves, will Chelsea dominate the flanks? Will they absolutely eat up all the space and Sterling would basically just run into dead ends until the end of time? Or will he receive help from a recovering James, a Malagusto, or perhaps another fullback that they'll randomly convert from midfield? And it's good to see that Conor Gallagher's actually making these number eight types of runs, you know, late in the box, that helps counter-press Arsenal down as well. So as for Arsenal, The unfortunate thing is that, well, you want to see, right, Arsenal have a lot of cohesion down the right side. And I think many of us were expecting, right, either Bukayo Saka or somebody shining down that light, right side, because they did it so well against Arsenal last week. So in this particular case, push come to shove, you know that Bukayo Saka is going to do something fantastic from that right side. Because down the left, well, I think it's safe to say that Martinelli, will he continue to operate as a number 9, which he showed against Man City? Or over here, will he just continue to stay wide? Because that left side for Arsenal continues to be an absolute mystery. It's malleable in the sense that they either use it as a striker's position, which they did when Trossard came on, or they just use it to hold with, but they just don't have a Granit Xhaka figure that bombs the box just yet. So that's why they had such a stuttering start.
Is it that they don't have the figure, or that they don't have the game plan to get that figure involved? They have players to play there. They have players that can do that.
They do. It's a matter of how often it happens, because it's predictable in the sense that the right creates for the left. And I think Arteta wants the left to be independent enough to create for itself. And that unfortunately has not happened.
I see Arsenal a little bit differently. I think Arteta wants the left to be, I think that Arteta wants the right to be control and the left to be chaos. So you need space for chaos. So he just leaves it open and kind of has no plan for the chaos. I think the intention is to make Arsenal less predictable, right? And I think actually what happens is it makes Arsenal more predictable, because Havertz is not a chaos player. Martinelli can be a chaos player with service, but when you have such diametrically opposed sides as a new tactic on using a side that's used to more control, then what happens is the left just gets forgotten. And nothing goes there, because you create from the right, create from the right, create from the right, and it's not setting up the left side chaos. Now, the return of Martinelli, we could see that chaos return, but the chaos doesn't suit Havertz's game, so Havertz wouldn't play there. So what, you're going to put Jorginho in the left half space? Like, what? I don't understand. I just think, like, Arteta's kind of overcomplicating things here from an attacking perspective, and it's showing in the data. Look at the stats. Arsenal away, 1.24 net XG. Arsenal away, 0.3 FDR compared to Chelsea, 1.0. So the FDR likes Chelsea's attack more than Arsenal's. I think that's absolutely insane, but Chelsea, I can see why Arsenal stats are depressed against Chelsea. Like you said, Chelsea are a well-organized side defensively. They may attack as individuals, but they defend as a system. And then they are difficult to break down, certainly at Stamford Bridge. So I don't know. I think these kinds of concerns are part of why I'm hesitating on bringing Arsenal in as was initially planned. I don't know, that's just something I'll be weighing all week.
Well, I mean, the good news is that Arsenal are very unlikely to play Chelsea away from home over the next few games, right? the whole reason a lot of people are wildcarding now is to see how much of a flat track bully they are, and you know, Sheffield United basically becomes the audition instead of this game.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so Sheffield United home, Newcastle away, Burnley home. But then like Brentford away, Wolves home. I mean, it's, yeah, the schedule is good. We'll see if Arsenal can ramp it up, because I just I don't know, have we seen the kind of domination? I mean, sure, the 4-0 away to Bournemouth. Drew 2-2 to Fulham, 1-0 to Palace, 1-0 to Everton. They haven't been that flat track bully this season. So we'll see, other than the Bournemouth game. So we'll see if I mean, obviously they'll dominate Sheffield United, but I'm just not certain how or how much. So one to keep an eye on for sure.
Yeah.
Let's see. We got a comment here. Poch cannot teach basic goalkeeping to an experienced Sanchez. Unforgivable error. Man, that, I don't know. That's a Sanchez error. Sanchez is just not very good. He's played well this season, but he isn't good. We know Sanchez from a long time ago. And he's been discarded by manager after manager after manager. He's had a good season, but he's not a good goalkeeper. And I will say the same thing about Areola. People get getting carried away about Areola. If you followed this guy's career, you know he's not a good goalkeeper. And that's going to come back to prominence here as the season progresses. He's played well, and I'm happy to own him in FPL and all of that. But these are goalkeepers with a history that we're, I think, conveniently forgetting in a little recency bias there. So, yeah, expect more of that from Sanchez.
I think, yeah, it's... Oh, I think we have to empathize a little bit with the fact that goalkeepers need to have a completely new game plan altogether, because you have to look at the perspective and how they're trained as goalkeepers. You know, I think not even say over the last 5 years, just this season itself, right? Goalkeepers have had to adapt to a brand new goalkeeping rule that has basically shaped the majority of how elite teams play. Do you know what that rule is? Like, there's a new rule right this season that all people play. So the rule is that goalkeepers are allowed to play goal kicks to a player that's inside their own box. So
that's not new this season. They've been allowed to do that for several seasons.
Well, positive. I mean, I saw this on The Athletic, and I thought that it was something
really from
either this season or last, where for the first time, goalkeepers were allowed to actually play the ball to a player within their own penalty area. And as a result, you get all these like massive crowding of their own penalty area from the get-go instead of, you know, play being extremely compressed in the middle of the pitch from every goal kick. And your training is different. You know, your run from the demand on the skill of your rondos to your center back's positioning. If you invite pressure onto yourself because your center backs are so wide and so deep, then you are bound to lead to more errors. I think this current crop of elite goalkeepers are suffering from, you know, having lacking the foundations to being ball players at the back. And yeah, it's caused all these new calamities. And, you know, we just got to wait for them to fade out or adapt.
I don't know, man. I mean, I do see like people's managers' insistence in playing out from the back as if that's some kind of pillar of football. Anything dogmatic like that, I think, is just misguided. And you do whatever the situation dictates, right? If you put your center backs just outside your six, and the other team brings five players around the box, then all of a sudden you got a bunch of space in midfield. So pop that ball in midfield, right?
Oh, that's intentionally the point, isn't it? I mean, you look at Man United's goalkeeper, for example, right? I think Onana was bought specifically for this purpose because he has that particular passing range to look for midfielders. I think that's also kind of why Man United are so invested into ball-playing central midfielders. You know, you've got so much variety. Even like when you look at the first team's quality from Casemiro to Eriksen and now to Amrabat. And I think at least it's safe enough to say that Ten Hag has been caught experimenting with inverting his fullbacks into midfield. Like he's done it with Luke Shaw, Diogo Dalot does it very frequently. You know, all this with the sole purpose of Onana playing these mid-range passes into midfield so that they can dominate possession. And it's just not worked out that well because, you know, compared to Chelsea, for example, where they actually attempt to play a high press. With United, in this particular case, if you sit off and don't press the Man United centre-backs, then Onana's passing range becomes useless, right? Because all the pressure goes into central midfield. I mean, I talked about this last week. where I think they suffered a loss against, was it Palace? No. Who did they lose against last week? Can't remember. But the
United.
Man United's chief loss last week came from the fact that you sit off the Man United centre backs and you just press their midfield and that's it.
They
You
beat
know?
Brentford 2-1.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
They
So
lost to
they trailed,
Palace in game
right?
week seven, the 1-0 to Palace
So
in
they
game week
trailed
seven.
against Brentford for majority of the game. And that was down to the fact that Brentford just set off Man United centre backs. Yeah. Right? It was the same game plan here. Sheffield United went toe to toe with Man United basically by using their two strikers to press United's two central midfielders instead of touching any of their centre backs. It was a very simple game plan that will continue to frustrate Man United because it doesn't allow Onana to showcase his best talents. It doesn't allow the fullbacks to bomb up the pitch. And you're just stuck, right? Because you're completely dependent on Bruno Fernandes pulling off a magic trick from deep midfield. Or you have to look for Rashford to hopefully come up with his own moment of magic down the left side. Yeah,
Well,
that's where United.
and on that one, I think I'll segue there. Bruno Fernandes, most dangerous player this week, and true enough, I mean, one assist, 0.34 XGI, five key passes, which makes him dangerous. But the other thing that I want to say is, like, this is that I want to highlight from the slide is dysfunction breeds variance for both teams. I mean, Sheffield United led for most of the game. Manchester United scored two goals on 0.51 XG in the second half. So I think the variance really kind of like showed itself. And as it has before in the past in this season for Manchester United, I think Manchester United is very lucky to be where they are, very lucky to have several wins under their belt in games that they should have lost. And there's not much more to say. Like I don't want to. Every team, every week, I want to see a different Manchester United it before we kind of like give them any
I
more
mean,
airtime.
what I mean, you run out of excuses at some point, and Diogo Dalot was the one that came up with the screamer from range, right, for the winner.
I hate that. I hate that Dalot scored. The people picking Dalot in FPL, and I'm like, you are absolutely insane. Manchester United will
I
never
mean,
keep a clean
it's
sheet.
was it
Never
Analytics
deserve a clean
FC
sheet.
that
What?
championed this pick, right? I believe it was
It's
Analytics FC
yeah.
that had
Yeah,
Dalot really high up there this week.
he was popping up and all, and I think it's an abysmal pick. It's just, I don't know. It pisses me off when picks like that return. It's like it shouldn't happen. Yeah, I guess. I would not buying Manchester be buying Manchester United defense or attack or anything. Sell
Fair
for me.
enough.
What do you think about Højlund? Talk to a little GV here is Højlund is ignored and as a striker, nobody's passing him to score. Maybe if Ten Hag brings Martial, then Rashford and Martial can both score. I don't know about that, but I don't know about Martial, but what's going on with Højlund?
It's about having Højlund in the right position to receive the ball and score. I think if we say that Darwin Núñez, for example, is a player that loves to receive the ball and swivel, Højlund is actually the exact opposite. He wants to minimize the amount of swivel he can. So he would be the kind of striker that would love to receive the ball outside a centre back, run onto it for a certain amount of distance, and then have the whole goal to aim at so that he can choose whether he wants to do that. Thierry Henry finished to the far post, whether he wants to blast in near post. Like Højlund needs space. And United are trying to play ball as if they're going to dominate teams such that everyone's going to be parked in their box. It's a bit of a mismatch. And I think Højlund has to adapt in some sense. How? Because is he big? I don't imagine him as a very big player because whenever I see him take shots, he's not trying to dominate a particular matchup. He's not trying to aerially climb over a center back. He's not even trying to like do Jamie Vardy things by like ghosting around center backs at the near post. He's the type that likes to receive the ball to feet, get like 5 yards created for himself, and then shooting from a narrow angle. That is my best impression of Højlund taking shots so far, at least in the Premier League, because I've not watched him in Europe. So that's where we are right now. And I think United needs space. in order for Højlund to thrive. It's the same thing with Martial. Martial is also another player that loves to have the ball at his feet, but he has to actually take two touches on his own to decide which way he wants to bamboozle his defender before finishing.
But I think it's unrealistic. Højlund is 6'3". He's a big guy and he's fast. So he's like you know, he wants to play similarly to, like, say, like Højlund with less physicality, right? He wants to stride past defenders and get into that space. That's why he was so good in Italy, because the whole system was designed that way, to draw in defenders, to get them wide with their wingbacks, and Højlund kind of like bombing into space. United don't do that. And to buy a striker, a young striker with not much experience, I think one decent season under his belt in Italy, and spend, I don't know, did they spend like Darwin Nunez money on him, like 70 million, 80 million, something like that? And then to bring him in and say, oh, now you have to change. Now you have to check to the ball. You have to be involved in midfield. Then why did you buy this striker? Why did you pay that kind of money? It's just like the level of dysfunction. Every time we talk about a new player, a different player for United, it's just a new level of dysfunction. Don't buy Højlund if you're not trying to get him in space behind defenders. So I think Højlund is always going to struggle against a back three. The back three is not going to step up and give him space. They're going to play him deep, and that's not his game. And I think, did I mention that here? I remember thinking it last week, but I might not have mentioned it in the slide.
Well, the slides mentioned that you test his support play more than his finishing. And United...
There it is. Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah. So the question comes down to, if Højlund does provide support, right? Let's say he does push out wide. What will he do from there? Because his runs out wide will not trigger a secondary run or even a third man run behind the defense for Højlund, the past two. You know, you cannot imagine someone, or you can imagine Bruno Fernandes doing it, but Bruno Fernandes actually prefers thriving on aerial balls from wide rather than through balls down the middle, right? I mean, when was the last time we've seen a through ball find Bruno Fernandes, right? It's always something from wide anyway. So that's kind of what we need, right? The kind of support play that Højlund has to be is the kind that actually pulls out wide and provides crosses into the box, as Jota does for Liverpool quite well. Have we talked about Liverpool? It's probably at the front order.
That was the first one.
Oh well. All right. So sorry about that. But yes, I think Højlund basically has to choose whether he wants to be a hustler like Ollie Watkins, or does he want to be a fox in a box like Diaby and hope for somebody to do the hard work for him.
I think Erik ten Hag needs to choose what he needs him for and develop that. I don't see any ten Hag development. I think that this conversation of Højlund further highlights the dysfunction in United. K7 says United is shocking. They are shocking. And I mean, you have a player like Højlund playing against the back three. You're not using him to move the defenders around. You're just using him to stretch an already deep line. What? And then you have nobody coming into the space in front of that back three between the back three and the center mids. Bruno's not getting into that space. Rashford's not getting into that space. So what are you doing with this plethora of players, all this money that you spent, all this acumen of development at Ajax and all that? Like what are you doing? In every area of the field, there's just dysfunction. And it doesn't all – in defense, it's forgivable because of all of the injuries. But in midfield and all of the attack in the front six or seven, it's unforgivable given the players that he has and the way he's set them up this season. They are shocking. I mean, and they're a bad team.
Strange as it sounds, I might add, United and Villa actually have a lot more in common. I just find that the difference between United and Aston Villa, which we will talk about next, is that Aston Villa know when to shift their influence away from their number 10 talisman and when to have it prioritize the front two. They know when to dominate the flanks and switch to a back three, whereas United permanently have this pressure to make Bruno Fernandes the talisman, but he does not actually show up for them week after week because Ten Hag creates either a narrow system that cramps the box, or he creates a wide system that doesn't rely on crosses or shots from wide. You know, it's worked once in a while. Like Marcus Rashford has, you know, shown on a couple of occasions that United get it right. But beyond that, United just aren't like using the right strategy against the right kind of opponent, or at least it's missed more times than it's hit this season. So I think when we talk about Villa up next, we'll get a proper juxtaposition of how Villa are doing it right compared to Man United.
Okay. I would also say Watkins' tool belt, the skills that he has is way more vast than Hoyland. And Emery's tactical acumen is way more vast than Ten Hag's. But so I don't know. I can see on a surface level how the similarities, but the personnel and the way they're employed, I think that's what we'll talk about now. And we will hurry it up. We got 5 minutes to go and we got two matchups. So we're gonna do this kind of quick fire. Aston Villa, West Ham. Villa, just domination at home, just utter domination. Like, West Ham do not get worked like this. What can you tell us about this fixture?
Well, I mean, West Ham are what's the word? Not misogynistic. They are, what's that term that you, when you like pain? Melancholic, no. So that word that starts with M, that you like taking a lot of pain.
Masochist.
Yes. Yeah, West Ham are masochists like that, right? They thrive on the pain. And so the question comes down to how hard Villa hit them. And I think, you know, Villa can attack water is wet. The question is, you know, I dove into this game with Diaby-shaped boots and why didn't I get wet? Right? So I can at least safely say that in all of Villa's attacking sequences, it's not that Diaby was nowhere to be seen. Like, you could freeze, you could take a screenshot of when Ollie Watkins or Douglas Luiz score his goals, when they scored their goals. Diaby was still around the penalty area waiting for rebounds or shots, you know, things like that. And honestly, in the early stages of the game, Diaby was the one releasing Watkins and Douglas Luiz and all those other players anyway. The biggest difference here was that Villa threw a spanner into West Ham's works that West Ham did not expect. They revolved their play around a genuine number 10. A single genuine number 10, and his name is Zaniolo. The number 10, well, traditionally, like over the last few games, Zaniolo was basically drifting out wide, basically replicating the McGinn role by, you know, drifting to the half spaces and linking play. But now Zaniolo's, he kind of behaved like a James Maddison type figure, and that completely threw West Ham off guard. West Ham were completely prepared for threats from wide. They're like, we're ready for Cash. Okay, we're ready for Watkins. Okay, we're ready for Diaby. Even better. And suddenly they had a central player in Zaniolo receiving the ball and overloading spaces. And they're like, ha, oh, wow. They completely could not cope. So all those matchups that you mentioned, Cash against Emerson, yes. Dean away from the Aston Villa central midfield, it was pretty much Zaniolo taking up all those spaces. And West Ham had to shift players left and right out of the way and into each other. As Villa took full advantage. I think the fact that Zaniolo does all this selfless hustling work allows Watkins to play this number 9 position. And I would like to reassure Diaby owners that next game against Luton, Diaby will definitely be in the box as one of the number 9 targets.
Okay, I'm going to step in here. We're at 58 minutes. We're trying to get out of here under an hour. Apologies for the rush at the end here. We do have one more matchup to get to. The one thing I'll say about Diaby is he is there to set things up for everyone else. And then when it comes time to get the ball back to him, it never came back to him. And he was pissed. He was frustrated in this game. Rightly so, and I'm frustrated as a Diaby owner. I don't know what happened, how they just stopped giving him the ball in the box or what, but with 1 minute left, going to get quickly on to the last matchup. Spurs 2, Fulham 0. In 1 minute, what can you tell us?
Kelvin Bessie. That was where Fulham fell apart. They did literally everything else well. Everything in the slides came true, and Fulham had one chance down the left side for Willian and Pereira to combine. It got snuffed out, and that was all she wrote. Spurs had a very clean 2-0 game, and they deserved this win.
Yeah, well, it was a clean game, but are Spurs, is their attack dropping off? What's happening?
Yes, I mean, not to say dropping off. It was already that dysfunctional. We don't exactly remember. We've already talked about all season how Spurs do not rely on a consistent plan A to do well. Their counterpress, every single aspect of their plan B came to fruition here. They dispossessed Fulham off the ball. Their pure intensity was what won them the game,
Okay,
capitalizing on Fulham
so
errors rather than doing something good themselves. And that's
fair
fine.
enough. 10 seconds to go. Thank you so much. Join our free mini league, HUP69D. Only a few weeks to go there. Thank you to all our haulers and super haulers. 5959. We are out of here. 1 hour has passed. Thank you to everybody in the chat. Really nice chatting with you, Lucien. I'm so glad you joined us. So glad you made it. No worries. I can't wait to hear about that mess. But since we went over an hour, I thought I'd say proper goodbyes. Thank you so much. We will be back with the matchups show tomorrow morning. So do join us then. And yeah, have a good evening, have a good afternoon, and enjoy the Champions League today. Peace out. Oh, wait. Yeah, I can do the video thing. I remember it this time. Peace.